Welcome to Radio Gorgeous's Gorgeous Entertainments. I'm here at Hoxton Hall, speaking with Karina Johnson, who is the director of three short plays. Could you tell us which plays?
So they are three plays. The first one is A Woman Alone by Franca Rama and Dario Fo. And the second one is a piece called The Immigrant, which is by Oneness Sankara, which is a new commission. And then the final one is A Mother, also by Dario Fo and Franca Rama.
Tell me, one, about the festival, because it's called Female Parts, and mm-hmm. this is shorts. Tell me a bit about the festival.
So it's been running since... Oh my gosh, the date. Sorry. It's been running since January, and it opened with a new musical. So the 3 months is work that just celebrates women at the centre. So women as producers, directors, curators, performers, writers. So all of the work has been made by women over this 3 month period. And the Female Parts Shorts ends this 3 month season.
Excellent. And the shorts will be running from March 13th to 31st. We'll repeat that at the end. Tell me about these three plays, because it seems to me that they're all sort of playing on stereotypes.
Absolutely, and deliberately so. So Franca Rama and Dario Fo were obviously very political writers and were very clear about their political agenda in the writing. And A Woman Alone is a woman who's trapped in her flat by her husband. So it sounds like that's a kind of terrible situation, and it is, but it's done with lots of humour, that sort of gallows humour that you have in terrible situations. And also, she's not a kind of downtrodden woman. She actually has quite a lot of spirit and fight, but what she needs to do through the piece is to make a decision about what she's going to do. And actually, for me, it's a play about taking control. And quite often, I think in normal life, people feel like things are out of their control. And actually, it mostly is going, I'm going to make that in my control. I'm going to make a decision. So therefore, that is in my control, and I can do something about that. So I think it absolutely is confronting the stereotypes about what kind of woman would be in that situation, because there are lots of stereotypes about what that means. And also what kind of character she would be, but she's a kind of hugely vibrant and witty character. And The Immigrant, you know, the title obviously is confronting lots of things that people think of as that, and we don't, you know, we're at that point in our society where people have very polarised views about immigration and what it is to be an immigrant. And this woman is... completely is against lots of the stereotypes that we think of, that the only people that come are people who are poor or who need to take something from our society and not necessarily giving back. That's the sort of rhetoric that we're in at the moment, which I find very disturbing and worrying.
And she does on paper fit some of those stereotypes, which
absolutely
is great. She's a Caribbean woman. She is an economic migrant.
Mm-hmm.
She has come for work.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, you're playing with the fact that the work she's come for is as a space engineer.
Yeah.
But she does sacrifice, as immigrants, many immigrants have to do, sacrifice family, sacrifice personal
absolutely
life in the pursuit of economic opportunities.
Absolutely.
In a foreign country.
And I think that for me is what is key, is that the debate and the dialogue that we're having at the moment is very much about what immigrants take and not what they give, and also not what they sacrifice. It's as if they're sort of empty vessels and then they come here and are created. And actually people have all sorts of circumstances of which they're coming from. And I wanted to commission this piece because I feel it's still a really current story. And I was on a plane journey coming from a conference in Europe, and I was sitting next to a woman who was just sobbing. And we started speaking. She was quite a young woman. And she was talking about having left her children in the airport with their dad and having to say goodbye and how awful that was, and how, you know, even Skyping and doing everything that we can now do, FaceTime, wasn't enough, and that she always felt awful, but that the economics meant that she could earn more being here than her husband could. And so that was the sacrifice she was making for her family, but she's sacrificing her emotional connection. And I feel like it's a reoccurring story. We feel like it's an old story, but actually it's happening to people who are immigrating now as much as it did for people who came in the 60s or 50s or whatever.
I was going to say, I'm as you can probably hear, an immigrant myself. And that one, the aspect of motherhood that you're, you know, just, it's holding guilt, you know, one way or another.
You give birth and it's guilty, straight up.
You know, you're never going to be right. You know, you're always, you know. But then also how everyone perceives you and not being able to, let alone with your children, but your wider family.
Absolutely.
You know, you're not present, you know. Which, the sense of guilt leads us nicely to the third play.
Absolutely. A mother who, that actually, interestingly, all of the characters are mother, but the last one is the only one that is nameless and is called a mother. And of course she feels guilty. Her son is the person who has done something wrong. However, as the mother's guilt is, you have to have it. She obviously thinks about what she has done to make him like that and takes more responsibility than she ever should, really. But it's that pressure and conflict between, obviously, politically and intellectually being completely opposed and disgusted by what her son has done, but emotionally it's still her child, it's still her baby, and she still remembers him as a more rounded character than the media version of this terrorist, this awful person. So it's about that kind of more complex relationship. And for me, I was interested in it because I think that the media portrayal is quite polarizing, and it's important that this is a middle class white young man that does this, because there are middle class white men that do this, and as we're obviously doing the research, there's lots of things that come up. But at the moment it feels very much like when a young white guy does something, he's just a lone crazy person. He's not part of anything bigger. It's not an ideology. He's just mad. Whereas other people who are not white are, you know, it's something kind of deeply entrenched within them why they have become this way. Absolutely.
Yes.
And I think it's really, that's a totally unhelpful conversation. And it means that we never really talk about the reasons why people become, because it's about some innate thing. And this play beautifully gives us an opportunity to go, so what is it? It can't just be, I'm just a crazy person and I just got up one day and did this thing. Of course, there are those rare people, but actually mostly there is a bigger picture, and it allows us to talk about that bigger picture and also to confront our own stereotypes about who are terrorists and who the mothers of terrorists are, what kind of people they are. So it's a really, it's a very clever piece, and although it's, you know, a 70s piece, is sadly still very resonant now and makes lots of sense.
And it's also interesting, you know, because how she finds out about what her son has done is through the news.
Yeah.
And that's also very fun, because we always see family and our close ones almost sort of inside, you know, as an interior, you know. Mm-hmm. We see them, when we picture them, it's, you know, when we were holding them in our arms or in a crib or in the bathtub or in our homes or, you know, but then all of a sudden they're public.
Yeah.
And you're seeing, it makes you look at them, at you, very differently.
Yeah. And I think the thing about discovering it on TV is that what she is confronted with is how other people see
mm-hmm.
him. Not, and that's the conflict between the kind of public view of her child and the intimate home version of her child, this fully rounded human being rather than just this scary, awful person. And, you know, people who do awful things their mother still loved them somewhere. And even if you kind of hate what they do and you still love them, that's a really difficult position to be in. And also we talk about, the piece talks about very much about how she's seen by other people, by association, that guilt by association is very real. And sensibly, lots of women don't appear on TV going, "No, my son never did that," because they realise that that guilt by association is, mm-hmm. is crippling.
Mm. Going back to the first play, I was intrigued by the idea that this woman who is, you know, sort of accepts at the beginning that she is very loved by her husband. It doesn't see that she is sort of trapped, mm-hmm. and imprisoned in a way by her husband. And I was just thinking that there's so many things, social media for one, and the incredible algorithms that enslave us, this idea that in other ways the things that we just accept because they're told to us,
mm-hmm.
By the government or by, you know, by whatever powers that be in our lives,
mm-hmm.
I've wanted you to explore that a little bit if you could.
I think she, without giving away the play, I'm not sure that she completely believes what she says about her husband. And what is interesting is about how she is, what she feels she deserves, because there are lots of expectations. And one of the things that we are playing with and what I wanted to look at around our varying identities depending on where we are. So, you know, I'm a born and bred Londoner, but my family are from the Caribbean, and there are different expectations in your home and in your cultural circle than there might be outside of that. So even with multimedia and, you know, access all the time, 24 hours a day, there are still expectations of your behaviour in your home. Some people, you know, some people's culture allows them to even have a different name at home. So you are almost an entirely different person at home than you are outside. And your work life, your public and private are very different. So,
let alone for you internally.
Absolutely. So I think that one of the things that is interesting about the piece is about that expectation of family, expectation of being a wife, expectation of being a mother, and how she should behave, and what she has done has contravened that expectation. So therefore she feels that there may be some justification about that. So you know, we marshal ourselves. That's how morality works, isn't it? That's what you hope you've done when you bring up your children, that you've given them a moral compass that's internal, that doesn't have to be externally, you know, put on them, but that they go, "Oh, that's not right. It doesn't feel right, so I'm not going to do that thing." And that's what we hope. And what's happened is that moral compass is so strong and rigid that she's finding it hard to go, "I'm not even sure that is actually proper morality," or, you know, "Does that really make moral sense?" And, you know, and the roles of women have changed, you know, and the expectations of our behaviour has changed. But that is not for everybody all the time. And that's what's interesting. And I think that sometimes as women in the world, or who are, you know, of a certain class or education, we kind of feel that everyone's like that. And then you go, quite a lot of people are not. Or, you know, quite a lot of people don't tweet and read this and read that paper or whatever. They have a particular worldview. And actually those, that access is a bit of a fallacy, because you just listen to people who feel the same way as you.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't necessarily have more knowledge, you just have more people reflecting what you think back at you. And you don't necessarily read things that don't agree with yourself. That echo chamber is very powerful. So that happens in a kind of physical thing, and it can also happen in a virtual world. So even though we think, well, surely she'd know to do this or do this, I'm not sure that you do. And I think that that's interesting to explore in this time when we think we've got it,
yes,
a little bit more together.
And everybody has access to everything.
Yeah,
and
lots of people, really, their worlds are very, very small.
Mm-hmm.
And and they haven't realized they haven't chosen that.
Tell me about how your thoughts. Okay, so the Oscars were last night, and Frances McDormand, you know, women's projects. Obviously, this was thought up quite some time ago in order to get things, you know, commissioned, and you know, it takes a lot to get things scheduled, commissioned, and the ball rolling. Quite a bit in advance. What was the thinking behind the female parts?
Well,
series?
I was interested. So I came to this building 3 years ago at Hoxton Hall, and I found it really intriguing that it had been run by women for a really long time. That's almost unheard of. I don't know another space that's been run by women for 40 years. The title has changed, you know, like cooks and chefs, and women are cooks and men are chefs. But actually the role in itself in terms of leadership is basically the same job. So I thought it would be a really brilliant opportunity to celebrate that. And, you know, the East End has a huge and long tradition of women running things, really, whether it was in name or not, but they absolutely ran the community business and just had the drive of what was happening. So it felt like an opportunity to do that. And then I had already decided that that's what I wanted to do, a piece of a season that celebrated women, you know, to confound or, you know, to challenge those stereotypes that women's work doesn't sell. And then obviously it also kind of coincided with the suffrage year, which I thought was an interesting thing to mark and to look at the kind of, actually look at the women who wouldn't have got the vote, because it was very, very limited who got the vote. Such as, I mean, they kind of did everything possible in that first, which we're celebrating now, to allow as few women as possible to have the vote. So the vast majority of women who were not as desirable, who were not the right class or the right age, did not get the vote. So it was an opportunity to go, what about all these other brilliant women who we accept now, but that who wouldn't have? And then I just also really, I read A Woman Alone a very long time ago, and it was one of a piece that I always thought I'd really like to do that. And the commission idea came up because of another project where lots and lots of women who had immigrated to this country kept on coming in and sharing their stories. And I was really struck by, you know, a really very senior elderly woman who came and talked about leaving her child and not seeing him for a very long time, as if it was yesterday, and her child was 40, and that she'd left him when he was like 2. So it still felt really fresh, and then kind of was picked up by having that experience on the plane more recently that I went, yeah, it's still relevant, it's not some other story. So it was an opportunity to do that, to celebrate and to kind of put the focus on by kind of critical mass of amazing and really, really diverse women. And it was important to me that it was a huge, you know, diverse art form, diverse women, different class of women, because that is also an extra barrier in art, in the arts, that actually it's great when people say we're doing an all-female season. You go, yeah, it was an all-female Oxbridge season. It's still, there's still some of the other challenges that we're not talking about in that. And I wanted to celebrate that women are really, we're just really different to each other. The only thing that these women in the season have in common is that they are all women and that they're all artists, but almost nothing else. Different art forms, different kind of, you know, politics, etc. So it's a really exciting to... It's been really wonderful, actually, to have a whole building full of women, you know, opening with a musical that had like 30 women involved. So we did a kind of big picture on the first day, which has made us feel very empowered, because it's very unusual to be in such a female environment. And it's not about in opposition to men. It's just going, that's really amazing, because we don't notice when we're in all male environments all the time or more of the time.
I want to talk a little bit more about some of your other work, because you're known as a person who has created some site-specific works, and that's a very different kind of creation. I'm speaking of Crossings, which was done at the Liverpool Docks, and Whose Blood, which was at the old Operating Theatre in London.
So, I mean, I think that I always say that I've made work that's site-inspired rather than site-specific, because I think people who do site-specific work are very, very clever. And they do some other stuff that I'm like, wow, how do you make that work? But I'm very much inspired by the environment. I think all the work, even if I'm making it a theatre piece, is always influenced by what's outside the door. That's the way I work, really. So these works are also inspired by, you know, they're all set in Hoxton. So Our Woman Alone is a Londoner, is a Turkish Londoner, because if you walk on our street, I'm sure you've seen lots and lots of Turkish businesses, and the neighbourhood is very mixed, but actually that's the second language spoken in Hackney. So it made sense to me to make something that kind of related to that mix. And our three plays actually are very representative of Hackney, because you've got somebody who's from the Caribbean, you've also got a very middle class woman who's very well educated, and that is the kind of lovely, brilliant mix of this area. Sometimes it doesn't work. There are moments when you go, oh, this is kind of, you know, it's not comfortable, those mixes, but actually that's the thing that I really love about it, and making those references to the world outside. So doing those works in, so even here, these works are site inspired, they're set in different spaces in our building to give you the sense of where they're set in a slightly different way. And they are confessional plays, so you're very close and you're in it. So in The Woman Alone, you are in her flat. We're not watching her flat. We are in her living room. We are in her space. And we have the opportunity of being able to do aerial here. So we're playing around with space. So yes, always trying to fit the work to the space, and it, you know, the two other pieces that you referenced there that I did before, Crossings and Whose Blood, were both historical pieces, so they were in those historical settings, and you know, we always try to raise the ghosts, really, of the kind of stories that we're telling about people who would have been there, and that's really exciting because it gives people an extra layer in the experience.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about arts funding in this crazy world, mm-hmm. and also coming up to post-Brexit, because I don't know if you get money from Creative Europe, but I know a lot of arts funding is mm-hmm. through Creative Europe, and that will dry up.
Absolutely. Well, Hoxton Hall doesn't get money from Creative Europe. Although as an artist I have worked on a number of European projects, so other site inspired pieces which have been European funded, so I'm very aware of how that works. Arts funding has always been a challenge. I think there's only ever been a very kind of brief period where it felt a little flush when the lottery started, and all of a sudden we went from having very little money to having a bit more. So everybody got like, wow, this is great, it's possible to do things. And I think that I don't see that is going to change radically in terms of arts funding is going to somehow become more. And obviously being out of Europe is going to affect funding, particularly for those projects that have international cooperation in them. And often that more kind of conceptual work that may not be focused on text and might have a kind of a longer gestation in its making and the development and creation. Because I think the thing about arts funding here at the moment is it's quite tailored to the system here, which is very short. So, you know, you have a few weeks rehearsal and then you're on. You know, if you say to someone, I would like to have arts funding and I want to do a project which is going to take 3 months rehearsal, and then we're going to do some other stuff, and then we're going to come back to it, that sort of way of working is almost impossible to fund in the UK, because it's very much predicated on you're going to work with text and you're going to rehearse for 3 weeks and then you're going to be on.
Delivery.
Yeah. So, which means that we make work quite differently from the rest of Europe. And I feel like that possibility of making work in a different way will become even more constrained with the changes in funding. But, you know, we've been really fortunate with this programme that we've had a lot of funding from lots of different sources. But as you say, it has to be planned a very long time ago. So we've probably been working on this project about 2 years. And, of course, it's kind of its delivery has coincided with a huge shift in terms of how the debate around women and feminism and, you know, all of that. But the thought and the impetus and the starting to raise the money happened a long time ago. It takes that long to make it happen. But yeah, I don't see how coming out of Europe is going to make it change for the better in any possible way.
Anyway, however, that being said, if you would like to see the fruits of Karina's labors, 2 years in the making, please come to Hoxton Hall, March 13th through the 31st, Female Parts Shorts, A Woman Alone, The Immigrant, and A Mother. Karina Johnson, thank you very much for being on Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you.
And for other fascinating women and for details about the shows, please go to www.radiogorgeous.com.